Welcome to part two of a special two-part episode of our bi-monthly program Post-Classical. First part of this program aired last evening at 8, and this is its conclusion. This special program is called Native American Inspirations. Part one is up on our website, wwfm.org, as a webcast. This program is hosted by Bill McLaughlin, Joseph Horowitz, and Angel Gil Ordonez, with special guest Delta David Geyer, music director of the South Dakota Symphony. Enjoy.
Man, that really transports you, doesn't it? In fact, if in the wrong place where you start, it could transport you almost to another planet. But that is all music from this earth, from South Dakota. What have we been listening to? Who's going to tell me what we were just listening to? And are those normal, modern orchestral instruments just played in very specific ways? Or are they Native American instruments?
So I will answer your question and inform you that you're listening to a distinguished Native American flutist playing a wooden flute in Brian Akipa, in combination with members of the South Dakota Symphony. In other words, a sort of characteristic product of this thing called the Lakota Music Project, which mediates between Native America and America. Mm-hmm. This is, in fact, a composition entitled Clear Lake and composed by a remarkable member of the South Dakota Symphony, Jeffrey Paul, who is the principal oboist. David Geyer, tell us a little bit about Jeffrey Paul.
Jeff's one of the most interesting musicians I've ever worked with anywhere in the world. He's a musical omnivore, plays all different kinds of styles of music, and has his entire life 2 degrees in oboe from Eastman.
Oh, it's a double reed. Sorry, that's a bad joke.
I got it.
Bravo, Bill.
He's a marvelous oboist, but he's been in on the ground floor of this Lakota Music Project and all in terms of not just playing, but also composing pieces and finding ways to compose. The word compose is rather fluid from this point on, in the sense that that piece that we just heard, Wind on Clear Lake, was composed during the summer on Clear Lake up near Sisseton, South Dakota, in the northeastern corner, which is an Indian reservation, composed with Brian Akipa, who is a NEA National Treasure, Native flutist. And Jeff had to come up with a totally different form of notation. So Brian does have flutes. He makes his own flutes, and they're pitched, you know, in different keys. And the scales that he uses, as you heard just now, don't line up with A440. But Jeff had to figure out how to make it work with a traditional orchestra.
Okay.
And did a wonderful job, I think.
Yeah.
So A440 refers to the A that the oboist gives. It actually cycles along at 440 cycles per second. That's where an orchestra tunes. That's standard Western tuning. But folk instruments are another story. They can be all over the place. Or they could be very flexible, too, can't they?
Yes, they can, and they play different scales. The tuning on the scales is quite different.
So contextualizing what you've achieved here, I think I have this right. You began visiting reservations with members of the orchestra, and there would be an alternation of musics. There would be a composition performed by the members of the South Dakota Symphony, and then there would be music performed by Native American musicians. And am I correct in inferring that a second stage was music combining the Native and non-Native performers?
Yeah, that's true. It actually took about 5 years to build this Lakota Music Project, and it goes back to that building of trust. And so I had one Lakota advisor who would take me around the state and introduce me to tribal elders and cultural leaders. And then we had Ronnie Tice, whom you mentioned in a previous hour, who was another one of our advisors, who came and taught our musicians about Lakota music and culture. And then there was a very pivotal moment on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation where we had basically a four-hour jam session between our two core ensembles, string quartet and woodwind quintet, and a Lakota drumming group called the Porcupine Singers. And we basically spent time just playing music back and forth for each other and talking about the role that music plays in our culture. And at one particular moment, the keeper of the drum, Melvin Youngbear, stood up and said, "You know, we sing the old songs. We're not a powwow group." I didn't know there was a difference. But he said, "We sing the old songs because we want to pass on the tradition to the next generation." And I said, "Bingo. That's exactly what we do as orchestral musicians. We have 500 years worth of this treasure trove of music that we play. We're just stewards. We're just here for a moment, and we hope to pass it along." And from that moment, we found the Lakota Music Project and how we could tour together and share traditional musics between our two ensembles. And yes, Joe, eventually have music composed for us to play together to demonstrate not just musical unity, but friendship through music. It's quite an extraordinary journey.
David, so, I'm fascinated with that comment you made about the difference between the old songs and powwow music. Want to give us a better idea what that is?
Well, so my understanding, I've been to several powwows now, but my understanding is that powwows didn't used to be this way, but now they are basically a dance competition. And there are prizes given. Sometimes it's big prize money. And there's also money given to the drum groups. They win prizes. And so some of these guys tour all over Indian country, up into Canada, all the way down to the Southwest, singing these powwows, which are competitions. And the songs that they sing are more popular in the what they do, as opposed to the traditional songs that were, you know, 100-plus years ago that have been passed along from generation to generation.
You feel comfortable making a distinction of what they sound? I mean, are the old songs more complicated? Or are they more intricate or subtle?
You know, I'm not that well-versed in it. I mean, I've been around it quite a bit now. What I can tell you is that when you get a powwow drumming group singing full-on, it's a rock and roll kind of experience.
That's what I thought. Sort of an Indian jam band in a way.
Well, so the music, it might be hard for us gringos to differentiate the music itself, the style of the music, but there's an energy shift. Like when they're singing the old songs, an honor song, you know, or the Lakota flag song, there's a reverence that's there. It's not hushed by any means. I mean, Lord knows it's loud when they sing and when they hit that drum, but there is a change in the character.
Well, thanks for trying to make that a little more clear.
We have time. I did my best.
Should we hear some more music? Joe, what do you think we should listen to next?
Well, we're going to hear now the entirety of Wind on Clear Lake, the very piece that we just sampled. And I have in my hand a brief program note by Jeffrey Paul. So I'm going to read this, and then we'll hear the piece.
Okay.
"Of the multitudes of clear lakes in North America, one stands out as particularly special. There is a deep spirituality about it that commands a quiet tongue and a listless ear. Clear Lake, South Dakota, situated on the Sisseton Reservation, miles away from everything except the rich and colorful history of its surrounding land, is a perfect respite from daily trials and tribulations. One senses with heightened awareness many generations of previous inhabitants. I was fortunate to be able to retreat to a cabin on Clear Lake as I began composing the piece and cultivating my friendship with cultural treasure, Brian Akipa." And David, what is the scoring of this piece before we hear it?
Well, the scoring that you're hearing is string quartet and woodwind quintet and Dakota flute.
I must say that having heard this piece a couple of times now, I find it wonderfully successful, not only in invoking the scene that the composer describes, but in somehow mediating between Native America and America musically and culturally. So here we are, Wind on Clear Lake by Jeffrey Paul.
Thank you.
So that was Wind on Clear Lake, as performed at the Washington National Cathedral as part of Post-Classical Ensemble's week-long festival, Native American Inspirations, music by Jeffrey Paul, the exceptional principal oboist of the South Dakota Symphony, and including the wooden flute of Brian Akipa. Before we go to another piece, I'd just like to say a few words contextualizing the achievement of the South Dakota Symphony. There was a guy named Theodore Thomas in the 19th century who had an itinerant orchestra, and he's one of the most colossal figures in the history of American music. Mm-hmm. It's partly because of Thomas that we acquired this notion that a symphony orchestra shows the culture of a community, not the opera house, and the symphony orchestra became an American specialty. But now in the 21st century, it's more challenging, it's very challenging for any symphony orchestra to show the culture of the community. And in my experience, David, it's your orchestra, the South Dakota Symphony, that most realizes that ideal. It's not that the whole orchestra is the Lakota Music Project, but your orchestra really does have a tangible and intimate relationship with the community that it serves. Do you want to say anything about that beyond what we've already had occasion to mention before we go on to the next piece of music?
I think it's been quite intentional. We, several years ago, articulated a new artistic vision, which basically takes the programs which are ancillary in most orchestras, education, community engagement, that sort of thing, and raise it up to the same level as our main stage programming in terms of importance to the organization. We've basically rebranded what the orchestra does, and we've also infused it into our main stage programming, so that each one of our main stage programs has deep roots into the community, whether it's, you know, when John Corigliano came for his first symphony last month and we had high schoolers all over Sioux Falls that were making their own AIDS quilts and, you know, that were, you know, really involved in, you know, in what it is to create empathy through art and all of that. So, like, all of the things that we're doing are all about connection to the community, and the community is the entire state of South Dakota because we're the South Dakota Symphony.
Without going into any further detail, but just to give people a picture that's a little bit more complete, tell us in a few sentences about your Mahler cycle.
Well, the Mahler cycle we just completed last spring. It was an orchestra building exercise. I mean, I love Mahler. You know, I studied with Bernstein. I'm, you know, a Mahlerite myself. But this orchestra had never played anything but the First Symphony. And I said to the orchestra before we got started, we'll be a different orchestra when we get to the other end of this. And that happened many times over through the course of the several years that it took. So, yeah, that was such a huge achievement, but it was also a community-wide achievement. That Mahler 8th Symphony that we did last April was a big hurrah from the entire community.
All right, so now we have a picture, or the beginnings of a picture, of the magnitude of what's been achieved in Sioux Falls and in the state of South Dakota. One other aspect of the South Dakota Symphony, which we need to talk about before getting to the next piece of music, are the composition academies. So by way of getting to Brian Akipa and Meadowlark, David, what can you tell us about the genesis of this piece and what it has to do with the way the Lakota Music Project works?
So one of the big questions I had when we started touring the Lakota Music Project 10 years ago was, well, you have a Mohican composer, and then you have a Chickasaw composer. When are we going to hear Lakota composer? And I would have to shrug and say, well, there aren't any as of yet. But little did I know the way that this was going to develop, because when Jared Tate became our composer in residence, one of the skill sets that he brought with him was that he, for many years, had been running academies for Native American kids in the Southwest. And he offered to do that for us as part of his composer-in-residence activity. So we embarked upon that about 2.5 years ago. And so now we've had 3 summers of these basically week-long camps, one on the east part of the state for Dakota kids and the other on the west side of the state for Lakota kids. They're high schoolers that participate in this, or at least that was the way it was originally framed. And this program has been an immense success, but it's done so much in terms of allowing us to invest in different communities, like the town of Pine Ridge, on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, you know, to be able to really invest in the kids there in the school. You know, kids are now using these compositions that they've done with us for college applications and that sort of thing. It's really been a beautiful thing. But Brian Akipa, to our surprise, told us that he wanted to participate in the Sisseton Composition Academy from the very first summer. And so Jared took him on.
So we're talking about a distinguished Native American flutist and dancer of long experience who does not read music and is not accustomed to collaborating with members of a symphony orchestra.
That's right. But he had a song of a meadowlark inside of him that he had to get out.
And we're going to hear him talk about it, actually, right now. And then we can move back to Genesis of Meadowlark. So here is Brian Akipa at the Washington National Cathedral last week introducing Meadowlark by telling us about the inspiration of this composition.
This song was based on Meadowlark, a Meadowlark song. And this was important to me because growing up, my dad would take me to my grandmother's out into the country, and I'd stay there all summer long. And it was way out in the middle of nowhere. Any direction you look, you could look, and there's just the nature and the meadows and the fields. And all day long you could hear meadowlarks. And I always thought the way my grandmother had this sustained system to support ourselves. And without any jobs or money, that's the way we lived. And we're out in a garden. And she said to me, "Listen to that meadowlark." She said, "This meadowlark can speak the Dakota language. And it says, and it says these words inside the melody that it's singing. And he's saying, sweet grass is over here." And she said, when he sings this, pay attention, because it's a special day. Something good is going to happen. And there's spiritual connotations. So all these notes, what I did was get a recording of a meadowlark and put it into music software on the computer. And the meadowlark sang too fast for us to get the notes, so we slowed it down as slow as we could possibly get it. And with a chromatic tuner, pulled out each note and notated it. And so all these notes are what I used to make this song.
That was the NEA National Heritage Fellow, Brian Akipa, who's also a recipient of a Living Indian Treasure Arts Award, a distinguished player and maker of wooden flutes, talking about the inspiration of a piece that he composed for Lakota flute, and Western instruments. David, who else participated in this compositional exercise? How exactly was it done? And then we'll hear the piece itself. Do you want to give us a little bit more insight?
Sure. So he began this piece with Jared Tate as his teacher, and they were the ones who took an actual song of a meadowlark and put it into the computer software, slowed it way, 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 way down where they could differentiate every note. And then Jared helped him to actually create a piece for woodwind quintet. This piece is in two parts, though, because the second part, Brian wrote himself into the piece, and that was with the help of another composer, Theodore Whipred, who followed Jared in being our composer in residence and has, for the last two summers, headed the academies. And Ted and I were colleagues at the New York Philharmonic for many years, did a lot of work together. He was the education director of VP of Education at New York Philharmonic. So it's a two-pronged piece, two teachers, and one part is just woodwind quintet, and the other part is woodwind quintet with cedar flute.
So here is the performance from the Washington National Cathedral of Meadowlark by Brian Akipa, with Brian Akepa and members of the South Dakota Symphony.
We were listening to flutist Brian Akipa. No, not one of those modern metal flutes. This is a beautiful Indian flute made out of cedar. Brian Akipa, his piece called Meadowlark, playing with members of the South Dakota Symphony there in that performance from the National Cathedral. Beautiful music. Enchanting, isn't it? Another world.
David, you want to tell us who the five wind players we heard from your orchestra were?
Sure. These are all the principals in our orchestra under the name of the Dakota Wind Quintet here. It's William Sedaniel flute, Jeffrey Paul on oboe, Christopher Hill on clarinet, John Tompkins bassoon, and Daniel Kitchens French horn.
So we're now going to end our two-part, four-hour Native American inspirations with a movement from the Hiawatha Melodrama, which was created and premiered by Post Classical Ensemble. And I've chosen the movement called Hiawatha's Wooing because it directly parallels the music with which we ended our first webcast, the Larghetto from Dvorak's Violin Sonatina, which, as we discussed, is a description of Minnehaha. This movement takes that music and creates a work for narrator and orchestra that incorporates Longfellow's verses, in which he describes the wooing of Minnehaha by Hiawatha. A melodrama, in musical parlance, is music that combines the spoken word and music. And the idea of creating a Hiawatha melodrama originates with the Dvorak scholar Michael Beckerman. Mike had put together a kind of skeleton, and I was so impressed by it that I thought it should be developed into a full-fledged 35-minute melodrama. And so I took what Mike had done and added my own mishigas. So this particular 10-minute movement is actually composed by me using material from the Larghetto and also from the Largo of the New World Symphony as a piano score that I then handed to my colleague Angel Gilardonez, who orchestrated it and conducted it with Kevin Days, who's well known to us. The result, which you're about to hear, is certainly pertinent to what we've been talking about for 4 hours, the relationship between America and Native America. We know that Dvorak was entranced by this poem. He first read it in Czech. He knew enough English to read it in English. And it was his ultimate aspiration in America to create an opera or cantata based on the Hiawatha story. He never got there, but we've done it for him. And this melodrama gives us a pretty good idea, I would say, not that I'm Dvorak, of what a cantata or opera by Dvorak on the Hiawatha legend might have sounded and felt like. Do you remember orchestrating this movement, Angel? What are your thoughts and memories of doing this?
Yes. Well, I mean, as Joe said, it was a wonderful experiment. I loved doing it. Of course, I didn't want to imitate Dvorak, of course. I mean, this is inimitable. But I did try to bring the sonority in a smaller group. What I liked very much is actually that the movements that I orchestrated from your piano version are actually more introvert. There is less orchestra.
Well, of course, this is a very intimate piece initially, and it's a very fragile part of the story.
Exactly. And then also the end is the same. So I like very much how balanced what we created is, you know, leaving the meat for the center of the piece, which is, you know, the real Dvorak. Yeah, I mean, I love orchestrating. It's something that I always say that composers have to conduct and conductors have to compose. Yeah, it was a wonderful experiment. It was a beautiful anecdote, actually, for the last movement. You remember, I misunderstood you. And we wanted to do the beautiful C minor part in the American suite. And
C sharp minor.
This is right. Exactly. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes, this is right. And then instead of a 3-4, I misunderstood, and it brought a beautiful funeral march for the end, because I brought a 4-4 with C sharp minor. It was a wonderful experience doing that.
So David and Bill, you're about to hear this probably for the first time in your lives, this 10-minute composition based partly on the Larghetto. Do you have any thoughts or questions before you encounter it?
Can't wait. Let's dive in.
So here then is the movement from the Hiawatha melodrama composed by Michael Beckerman and Joseph Horowitz, with parts orchestrated by Dvorak and other parts orchestrated by Angel Gilardonias, Hiawatha's Wooing, post-classical ensemble conducted by Angel Gilardonias, with Kevin Days as narrator, reading verbatim verses by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
As unto the bow the cord is, so unto the man is woman. Though she bans him, she obeys him. Though she draws him, yet she follows. Thus the youthful Hiawatha said within himself and pondered. Much perplexed by various feelings. Listless, longing, hoping, feeling, dreaming still of Minnehaha, of the lovely laughing water. There the ancient arrow maker made his arrowheads of sandstone. With him dwelt his dark-eyed daughter, wayward as a Minnehaha, with her moods of shade and sunshine. Eyes that smiled and frowned alternate, tresses flowing like the water, and as musical a laughter. And he named her from the river, from the waterfall, he named her Minnehaha, Laughing Water. Was it then for heads of arrows that my Hiawatha halted in the land of the Dakotas? Was it not to see the maiden, see the face of laughing water peeping from behind the curtain, hear the rustling of her garments from behind the waving curtain? As one sees the Minnehaha gleaming, glancing through the branches, as one hears the laughing water from behind its screen of branches. Thus departed Hiawatha to the land of handsome women. Through uninterrupted silence with his moccasins of magic. And he journeyed without resting till he heard the Minnehaha. Straight the ancient arrow maker looked up gravely from his labor, bade him enter at the doorway, saying as he rose to meet him, Hiawatha, you are welcome. And the lovely laughing water seemed more lovely as she stood there, neither willing nor reluctant, as she went to Hiawatha. Softly took the seat beside him, while she said, and blushed to say it, I will follow you, my husband. Pleasant was the journey homeward, through interminable forests, over meadow, over mountain, over river, hill, and hollow. Short it seemed to Hiawatha, though they journeyed very slowly. Though his pace was checked and slackened to the steps of laughing water. From the sky benignant, looked upon them through the branches, saying, Oh, my children, love is sunshine, life is checkered, shade and sunshine. Rule by love, O Hiawatha. Thus it was they journeyed homeward. Thus it was that Hiawatha brought the sunshine of his people, Minnehaha, laughing water, handsomest of all the women in the land of the Dakotas. In the land of handsome women.
That was Hiawatha's Wooing, the first movement following a prologue of the Hiawatha melodrama, which I had occasion to create with Mike Beckerman, with orchestration by Angel Gilardonias.
Well, thank you, David. I should give you your full name. Delta David Geyer, you told me. That was your pop's name, you told me. Delta.
Yes, my father's and my grandfather's and my son's.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. So I just wanted to give that proper mention. Thank you so much for joining us all the way from Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
And it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful ensemble you brought there. This is Bill McLaughlin, and anybody wants to play Dvorak's Going Home, which is the words we use when we sing a song, it's fine by me. I can hear that over and over again, even when it's played outside my window on the fireman's celebration or marking the tragedy of September 11th. They show up with four bagpipes to play it over and over again. Even when they play it with the wrong note, I still love it. It's a beautiful way to end the show. We'll get a little more music before we're out here, but thanks very much to Joe Horowitz, to Angel Gilardonias.
Thank you, Bill. Always a pleasure.
And to you folks for sticking with us. This is a really, really interesting trip, but that's always the case with you, Joe.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks, David. Thanks.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
So thanks for joining us on Post Classical. And listen on a little further. We're going to find some more music. I think more Dvorak from the hour. Thanks for joining us.
And Mr. McLaughlin is correct. We will have a little more music for you here on the way out. We'll hear the final two movements from that Hiawatha melodrama using music of Dvorak, arranged by Angel Gilardonias, the text Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, this melodrama put together by Dvorak scholar Michael Beckerman, and our host Joseph Horowitz. Post-classical ensemble is led by its music director Angel Gilardonias, the voice, that of bass Kevin Dace. The fifth movement, The Hunting of Pau Pukiwis, and the closing movement, the epilogue, Hiawatha's Departure. This coming from a Naxos release called Dvorak and America. Part one of this Native American Inspirations is up on our website as a webcast, as will be this part two for your listening enjoyment. As with all these post-classical broadcasts, I want to thank our recording engineer in New York, Bill Zygmunt of Digital Island Studios. Check them out at digital-island-studios.com. The next post-classical will come in February of 2020. Post-classical is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.
You shall hear how Pau Pukiwis, he, the handsome Yenadize, vexed the village with disturbance. You shall hear of all his mischief and his flight from Hiawatha and his wondrous transmigrations at the end of his adventures. Now from his lodge went Pau Pukiwis, climbed upon the rocky headlands, perched himself upon their summit. Round him hovered, fluttered, rustled Hiawatha's mountain chickens, and he killed them as he lay there, slaughtered them by tens and twenties, threw their bodies down the headland. Perched upon a crag about them, at length shouted Kayoshk the seagull, "It is Pau Pukiwis! He is slaying us by hundreds! Send a message to our brother, tidings! Send to Hiawatha!" Full of wrath was Hiawatha, when he came into the village, found the people in confusion, heard of all the misdemeanors, all the malice and the mischief of the cunning Pau Pukiwis. Hard his breath came through his nostrils. Through his teeth he buzzed and muttered words of anger and resentment. "I will slay this Pau Pukiwis, slay this mischief maker. Not so rude and rough the way that my wrath shall not attain him. I will slay this Pau Pukiwis, slay this mischief maker. Not so long and wide the world that my vengeance shall not reach him." Then in swift pursuit departed Hiawatha and the hunters. and aloud, cried Hiawatha, from the summit of the mountain, not so long and wide the world, not so rude and rough, but my wrath shall overtake you, and my vengeance shall attain you. Over rock and over river, through bush and brake and forest, ran the cunning powerful Kiwis. Like an antelope, he bounded, till he came unto a streamlet in the middle of the forest, to a streamlet still and tranquil that it overflowed its margins. Over rock and over river, through bush and brake and forest, ran the cunning powerful Kiwis, to a dam made by the beavers, to a pond of quiet water. On the dam stood Powerful Kiwis, o'er his ankles flowed the streamlet, flowed the bright and silvery water. And he spake unto the beaver, with a smile, he spake in this wise. Cool and pleasant is the water. Then he heard a cry from above him, heard a shouting and a tramping. Through the roof looked Hiawatha, vain your manifold disguises. With his club he beat and bruised him, beat to death poor Powerful Kiwis. But the ghost, the Jebby in him, still lived on as Powerful Kiwis, and it fluttered, strove, and struggled, till it took the form and features of the cunning Powerful Kiwis, vanishing into the forest. Next, the people of the village saw the wings of Powerful Kiwis flapping far up in the ether, followed fast by Hiawatha. Then the cunning Powerful Kiwis, once again in human figure, came unto the headlands. There without stood Hiawatha, smote great caverns in the sandstone, cried aloud in tones of thunder, "Open! I am Hiawatha!" But the old man of the mountain opened not. "Open! I am Hiawatha!" Then he raised his hands to heaven, called imploring on the tempest, called Wewasimo the lightning, and the thunder, Animiki, and they came with night and darkness, sweeping down the big sea water from the distant thunder mountains. And the trembling Powerful Kiwis heard the footsteps of the thunder, saw the red eyes of the lightning, was afraid, and crouched, and trembled. Then Wewasimo the lightning smote the doorways of the cavern, with his war club smote the doorways, smote the jutting crags of sandstone, and the thunder Animiki shouted down into the caverns, "Where is Powerful Kiwis?" And the crags fell. Oh. and beneath them, dead among the rocky ruins, lay the cunning Paupu Kiwis, lay the handsome Yenidize, slain in his own human figure. By the shore of Gitche Gumee, Hiawatha stood and waited. Gone was every trace of sorrow. As of one who in a vision sees what is to be, but is not. On the shore stood Hiawatha, launched his birch canoe for sailing, sailed into the fiery sunset, sailed into the dusk of evening. Thus departed Hiawatha in the purple mists